is Inside Petaluma. And got a few music songs showing you some anticipation of what's about to happen. So we're going to all right, thank you for joining us. This is Inside Petaluma. You're on, or we're on, I should say, KPCA LP 103.3 FM. We're broadcasting out of Petaluma, California. And today we're going to have a good show, but I will have to apologize for starters. I am a little still of a rookie on the board here, so I'll do what I can. But our normal host of the show, Cindy Thomas, can't be with us today, so I'm filling in. But we do have Janice Cater Thompson here, and we have a special guest who we'll announce in just a moment. How are you doing this morning,
Janice? I'm doing good. How are you, Jason?
I'm doing great.
Good. It's a beautiful day, and I've got
a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
A beautiful day in the neighborhood. As a matter of fact, I think that movie is opening, Mr. Rogers.
Oh, yes.
Yes. And so I think its grand opening is very soon, which I saw the documentary with Mr. Rogers.
I want to see that.
Which was fabulous. And then Tom Hanks being Mr. Rogers is going to be a lot of fun to see how they play it out.
Oh, I'm sure it's
and so it's going to be fun. And it's not just for children. It's actually for adults. And one thing about Mr. Rogers was he was a very kind and compassionate person.
Yeah.
And then the evangelicals started attacking him.
Oh.
And that is what was so shocking to find out about how they brought him down.
Well, I still remember how he famously delivered a speech to Congress regarding the importance of funding public broadcast.
That's right.
And
he was a pastor, I believe, or a...
I'm not sure, but he always kind of held it below the sleeve.
Well,
how should I say that? It's not a great expression. But I don't think he was very overt about it. I never got that impression as a kid.
No, I never did either because he brought the kindness out. Yeah. It wasn't the dictatorial way of today.
I read somewhere that he had some military background as well. But
I don't really remember that part.
Anyway, we're going off on a tangent as we often do.
Yes, we do.
Were there some things you wanted to touch on?
Well, I kind of wanted to talk about a few things in the Argus Courier and some meetings that I recently have been to last Monday at the Petaluma City Council. In the Argus Courier, council direct staff to pursue Rainier deal a little bit deceiving.
Yeah.
And so they're really talking about a Warmington residential has been working in the background with, I believe, Councilmember Mike Healy.
Mm.
And on October 17th, he got Councilmember King and Miller to sign a document, a memorandum they gave to the city manager, basically demanding that this project come before the city council. And because of the fires, it got pushed back, and so Teresa Barrett was not there, but it was a very, very important meeting. And in the memorandum that I assume Mike Healy worked with the developer to come up with the deal, millions of dollars of public funds are being expended.
Hmm.
And any time a project does not have a formal application, that means the citizens are now paying for them to go through the process.
The whole thing's a little weird to me because it sure seems like they should have waited to have our mayor included in the discussion on this. But I assume when she's back in town that she'll be weighing in.
Well, I'm hoping she does because this is really important and it really ties into the future sales tax to extend what was called Measure M at the time, the 101 widening.
Yep.
And so this is what's going on with Sonoma County Transportation Authority. They're trying to extend this tax. And I was having a very difficult time getting the list that the city of Petaluma has submitted.
Oh.
Well, fortunately, SCTA, Sonoma County Transportation Authority, sent me the list.
Oh.
And what's missing is the Corona overcrossing built in 1956.
Oh.
The city needs to put that on that agenda because of the rail station on the corner of Corona and McDowell, which is now in flux also.
Well, there's a lot of moving parts.
There are. Actually, yes.
And listeners might want to listen to the last show that we did where we had our council member, Healy. We've archived that show. You can go to InsidePetaluma.com, actually. That's just InsidePetaluma.com. You can listen to the archived show. We've also included, or I posted, a few links there. One is a article about the need for more public review and discussion about Rainier itself. It was from Councilmember Kevin O'Donnell, which was somewhat of a rebuttal to the other article that was... promoting Rainier as being progressive, which I thought was interesting, given that it means opening up a pristine area by the river to development. So anyway,
well, I'll tell you what's really disturbing is I went to the Sid Common discussion also, which is another development project. And I would go way back with and our guests and I, and you know, before the flood control project was done, these areas, three times the Payran area flooded, and it was up to people's ceilings.
Yeah.
And what's happening right now is the city council is moving forward with developing in what was floodplains and floodways because they think they can, and yet we have a climate change committee that was just appointed, and we're moving forward with 1962 thinking, and it's 2020.
That concerns me as well.
Yeah.
You know, particularly when we don't know what's going to happen with sea level rise.
That's right.
The estimates keep increasing.
Right.
I read it was 2 feet a little while ago. Now that's being raised. So we do have to approach these things with a longer view in mind. And the other fundamental question is, do we want to be encouraging more car traffic? I mean, is that the mode that we want to be encouraging by producing more roads?
Every one of these projects that the majority on the city council are promoting are all car-oriented.
Yeah.
And that's what's really disappointing. Yeah. And they're piecemealing it.
And often, if you think about it, it's really not that smart.
It's not smart at all.
given what we should be doing. And that brings us
to
our guest.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was trying to weave in a little tangent here that gets us into our guest. So we have Deborah Fudge here. I want to give you a little bit of background before I let her start talking. Although you can cut me off any time, Deb. Deborah Fudge has been actively involved in Windsor since 1994 when she was appointed to the Windsor Planning Commission. In 1996, she was elected to the town council and still serves as an elected there. She is the only six-time mayor of Windsor and currently serves as vice mayor. Deb was appointed to the 12-member SMART Board of Directors in 2005 and has served as chair twice. Deb is very proud of helping to create Windsor's transit-oriented development and town green, as well as working with the SMART Board and staff to create the first rail commuter agency in the North Bay. She is looking forward to the opening of the new Larkspur and downtown Novato train stations in just a few weeks. Thank you for joining us today, Deborah Fudge.
You're welcome. It's fun to be in Petaluma.
It is fun, isn't it?
It is fun.
Yeah. So before we start getting into SMART and all those other things, maybe just give the listeners a little bit of background on what got you into, your first position in Windsor was a planning commissioner.
Well, I moved to Windsor in 1990, and it didn't have a downtown. It didn't feel like a town with a heart to me.
Yeah.
The reason I moved to Windsor was I could afford to buy a house.
Yes, that's the way a lot of people move up to the North Bay.
I could afford to buy a house. And I had moved to Sonoma County in 1989. I worked at PG&E then, and I got a transfer up to Santa Rosa, which made me really happy. And my grandmother had lived in Sonoma since 1945, and she was aging, and I could be close to her and go help her every few weeks. And so I was excited to get the transfer from PG&E. Uh-huh. And so I lived in an apartment in Santa Rosa for a year, and then I inherited a little bit of money from my grandfather, $20,000, which was my down payment for a house. And I started looking around at little tiny 800-square-foot two-bedroom, one-bath houses in Santa Rosa, and they were $189,000, and I couldn't afford them.
Yeah.
And so I found an old farmhouse in Windsor, a 1934 farmhouse that needed a lot of help for $150,000.
Wow.
I bought it.
How cool. And how long has that been then?
I've owned that house 29 years in 2 weeks. I know.
Wow. I bet you it's worth more than you paid for
it. It's worth more than $150,000 right now. I did have to do a major remodel, lift it up, and put a foundation under it. But after that, it started to increase in value a little bit.
Yeah. Right. Tell us a little bit about the development in Windsor, because like you just alluded to, when you moved there, there wasn't much of a downtown. You were pretty involved with the town green in the center, correct?
Yeah, so I have a planning background, a city planning background. I got a master's in environmental planning, and I actually was a state planner in Jerry Brown's governor's office of planning and research for a few years in the 80s. So I have this planning background, but I was doing hazardous materials management and environmental services at PG&E, and I really missed the planning, which came really naturally to me. So in 1994, when Sam Salmon was elected to the town council and Lynn Morehouse, there was an
This goes way back, and I know all these names. This is frightening.
And you were involved then.
Yes, I was.
We were all buddies.
Yes, and still are.
And still are. So there was an ad in the water bill, we need new planning commissioners. And so Sam appointed me to the planning commission, and nobody in Windsor knew me. I'd only lived there 4 years. But when he heard about my planning background, he appointed me to the planning commission. I was made chair my second year. And we started talking to the town council about wanting a downtown and a town square, we called it. And the council voted no on that. So I was asked to run for council in 1996, and I was so shy. I thought, I can't do that. And I was talked into it, and here I am all these years later. And darned if we didn't build a town green, a downtown, a transit-oriented development, a train station, and now the train's coming to Windsor.
And I just want to say that yesterday I met a man from Windsor, and we were talking about Deb Fudge. You know, I mentioned that I knew Deb, and they knew her, and you are highly regarded in your community for what you've done and really bringing that town green. And I remember you pushing that town green, and it's fabulous that you have created a community space, and you should get a lot of credit for that.
Well, I wasn't the only one, but
it takes in a small group.
Well, many, as I said before we came on, I mean, many people are pointing to that as a model for sustainable development, and which I appreciate as well. I mean, I studied environmental studies in college. And, you know, way back then, we were talking about the need for sustainability. Now it's a real buzzword all over the place because, in many cases, we're a bit late to the punch. We should have been doing this many years ago. But my sister was going up north, and she was asking me, there was this little town. It was just an amazing little place with this nice town green and everything. I would love to move there. And she was talking about Windsor. And for me, it was kind of, I have to say, at first I was surprised because my brain was still in the old Windsor of what it used to be like. It wasn't bad. It just didn't have that.
It didn't exist.
It
was a name. It was a bedroom community.
Yeah. It was a lot of houses and a grocery store. Right.
Yeah. And I think there were some crime issues as well that I remember hearing about.
In the early 90s, there was a little bit of gang activity.
Yeah. And I think that was pretty much everywhere in the county.
Yeah.
Well, it still exists, I'm sure. And, of course, it was famous for, there was an article about this, I think, a year ago or something, for the people that were creating Orange Sunshine LSD in the 60s and the 70s. So that's kind of interesting.
It's actually a true fact, and we know where the house used to be, and there's a subdivision house on top of that house where that property is. And
that's funny.
I think those people just became aware.
There's actually there's a documentary all about it I just recently saw on Netflix, and it was just kind of a kick. I was like, wow, all that happened in Windsor.
Oh,
wow.
I watched that, too, because I didn't know the history for a while.
Oh, that's
very
cool.
Going to
say something?
No, I was just going to say, we just had fires, and
Windsor
really was a model, or this whole process ended up being a model of how you protect communities, making barriers. Mm-hmm. It is still very different than the 2017 fire, because that just came, and it was nighttime, and that thing just came roaring, but tell us about what happened in Windsor, because I was talking to this man yesterday who lives in Windsor. He's been out of his house for a month because of the smoke. And what people don't realize is the smoke got into his insulation and the flooring. They had to pull insulation out. And so I don't think people, and of course his insurance is covering it because they are, but I don't think people realize what people actually go through. Your house might not burn down, but you still have PTSD and trauma. And just let us know what you know best.
Today there was a fire. It was a condo fire not very far from my house near the freeway. And I got a text in the morning, there's a condo fire, 2-alarm fire. A person is deceased, and we could all smell smoke. And we all have PTSD. I mean, even though it's not a wildfire, it's a fire.
Yeah.
But Windsor, I have to say, we were prepared this time. But we had so much help from, we have 506 fire agencies in Sonoma County, and they made a stand in Windsor that saved Windsor. It was touch and go. There, I was in the emergency center with staff, the mayor, Dominic Fapoli, and I. And I think it was about midnight, Saturday night, 12:30 in the morning. And the fire chief turned to the two of us and said, I have bad news. I think we're going to lose all of Windsor in the morning, at, you know, starting at 3 in the morning.
Wow.
And we just looked at him because that man does not speak lightly.
And this is even the town green, the whole?
The whole, all 10,000 houses, everything.
Wow.
He said, the wind is going to change. It's going to, it's, the wind is on the hills above us, above Foothill Park, and it's going to change about 30, 40 degrees and head directly down the you know, Windsor. And my house is on the street where the fire would have head down on Hembry.
So
and
this would have meant crossing the highway then, right? Because wasn't it to the east of the highway? And Windsor's to the west, right?
No, the highway splits us in half.
So the town green's on the
west
side, yeah.
But there's a lot of houses on the east side where my house is.
So east side was more in danger, not...
All of Windsor
all
was
of
in
Windsor.
Danger.
Yeah, I guess so that's why there was an evacuation.
Because I saw some photos of the barriers and how they had the fire trucks around. And, I mean, it went right up to people's backyards. And that's what this man was saying. His home was one of them that they actually saved. And he's hoping to go back soon.
Right.
Yeah.
Those homes, so we thought the fire was going to head straight into Windsor at a huge rate of speed. And they knew they had to hold it before 101, which meant my house would have been gone.
Wow.
If they couldn't hold it way before 101, my house would have been gone. And they had to hold it at 101 because if they didn't hold it at 101, it was going to march all the way to the ocean. And Linda Hopkins, Supervisor Linda Hopkins, mm-hmm. and I talked about that because we were together a lot during the fires at all the county briefings. And so it was a real reality. I mean, it was in the middle of the night. We couldn't talk about it on Facebook. We couldn't, you know, everybody was out of town, but we didn't want to worry people.
Right.
But we knew that that's what was going to happen. The wind didn't quite change direction enough to... you know, fly into Windsor the way it did, but it did change enough direction to go into Foothill Park.
Right.
And there were 40 homes and cul-de-sacs that back up to the park, and those are the homes that started to catch on fire.
Wow.
So that was a little bit later. And we had 200 fire trucks from all different agencies, and the ones that stand out are Huntington Beach and Pasadena.
Uh-huh.
And our fire chief and our fire marshal, and there were four people per home up into the cul-de-sacs because the fences were on fire and they were already stationed there.
Oh.
They were stationed there before because they saw this coming. I have to say fire modeling has come a long way.
Yes,
fire and wind modeling, really, they knew what was going to happen. And so the fire...
Unless it's a hurricane coming off of Florida, and that's a little
tricky.
It's kind of like that circle, you know,
around
the map.
Yeah, we can model fires pretty well now. And so the fire chiefs and all of the people from all of the trucks that were there went into people's backyards. They tore away wooden fences away from houses, took all their flammable materials in the backyard, threw them on the driveway, and started using garden hoses. So I went up into the fire zone before evacuation was lifted. The fire chief let the mayor and I go in with under special National Guard permission.
Mm-hmm.
And we went court to court and saw all of the hoses in the driveways and all of their, you know, lawn furniture and barbecues and toys and thrown on their driveway. But some of those houses, the roofs did catch on fire. So not only did they have huge smoke damage, but there are people out of their homes dealing with insurance, and including our own town clerk. Her home was actually harmed the most.
Wow. Yeah, the roofs that were catching fire, are these wooden roofs?
You know what? I'm not positive. They probably are older shake.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, our house has cement.
Tiles,
yeah. And I guess that's safer. I don't know what the new model is for new building codes and things. But obviously that's something we have to take
into account. I have a new roof, and it's quite a 50-year roof.
Uh-huh.
But it should not start on fire.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Because
that's the problem. People don't realize you have embers that fly with the wind.
Right.
So even though the fire may not be near you, the wind can carry an ember to your backyard or wherever, and your house can be at risk.
Well, the roof might not start on fire, but you have the joists and everything else that can, and then get underneath those.
Yeah.
We had three spot fires, so that wasn't the only fire. There was another one on Arata Lane. There was another one on Brooks Road North where Guy Fieri just bought a house, and the fire got within inches of his house.
Wow.
And then there was another fire in a vineyard in sort of southeast Windsor, and we call it the Lockwood spot fire. And a person whose home is like a quarter and a half mile away from there, mm-hmm. he went on his roof last weekend and saw a big burn spot on his roof. And he had a composition tile.
Wow.
It wasn't shake, but you could see where there was a big black round circle. So an ember cast had flown onto his house, which was super close to Old Redwood Highway.
Ember cast.
Those are new words. Yeah, I learned that. Oh,
so
I like that.
This is back to sustainability. Obviously, part of this is due to climate change. We're having more. I mean, we've always had fires, but they're becoming. It's becoming worse, and there's certainly a correlation there. And of course, also we've been building out more into rural areas. So those two things are kind of working against us. How was the smoke?
The smoke was pretty bad. I got to drive through Windsor at 2:30 in the morning, the night that we thought we might lose Windsor.
Yeah.
It looked like you couldn't see because
right.
the smoke was so
thick.
You were
wearing a mask, I take it.
Yeah, and we were with the police chief and the town manager. But we did a last drive, what we thought would be a last drive through town, and there were ashes falling on a rattle lane, and the smoke was so thick. And then we went back out because, you know, it was about time for the mm-hmm. firefight to start. But when I came home and I was a half a mile from where the Foothill Fire was, my house was full of smoke, just like everybody else's. I don't smell it as much now, but many, many people in Windsor are hiring those cleaning companies and going through their insurance claims and having, you know, all their clothes washed and their couches cleaned and carpets and drapes and insulation taken out. So it's affecting quite a few people in Windsor still.
Well, if you think about it, too, when you have a fire like this, it's not just wood. I mean, it's all kinds of
toxic
stuff
yeah.
that you're breathing. So I imagine, you know, if we get more and more exposure like this, we're going to start seeing some health.
We'll talk a little bit about the sheriff and the decision to evacuate, which was a huge evacuation. I mean, my opinion is that I understood why he did it,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think anything negative about it.
Right.
And so I'm just curious. You're more in the inside than I am, so.
Well, the town council was warned at 8 a.m. that the announcement would go out at 10 a.m. that we were going to evacuate, and that was the first I heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
So really, Windsor went into shock but moved out, and everybody had to be out by 4 p.m., and I was out at 4:15, and I had because I'd been to a fire meeting and I was a little bit late. My sister had come up from Oakland to get my cats at an instant's notice. And I was one of the last people out, and Windsor was a ghost town. And nobody called and complained. Nobody texted. Everybody loaded their cars and got out quietly. Now, there was a traffic jam at 2 p.m.,
yes, there was.
But it was the smartest decision I think they ever made. And they said because if people had stayed in Windsor, they could not have mounted that firefight.
The other point.
They would have been saving people.
Interesting.
And they would have been, you know, trying to get people out of town, and the houses would have started.
So part of it is just so the firefighters can do their job.
Yes,
right. And that's what people weren't really understanding. They were saying, you know, why are we all being evacuated?
Right.
But it's really about getting that line of defense in there and not having to worry about going door-to-door with people.
Right, and having fire engines. And I saw...
Well, also traffic. Like, how were people moving about? I mean,
slowly.
Was there a panic? I mean...
No, it was very orderly. And
and
the fire marshal spoke to the chamber yesterday, and she said that, and I noticed the same thing, it was very orderly. Nobody was honking. I mean, some people were stuck on Old Redwood Highway for 45 minutes,
mm-hmm.
but they were all out on time, and they were very polite. And then I have to say another thing about Windsor is that when we came back to town, I helped organize a big thank you event on the town green with all the thank you signs. It was somebody else's idea, and I orchestrated it. And I hoped for 3,000 people out to thank all the first responders. We had 5,000 people with handmade signs, and people were crying, and we had speeches. But the town, if we weren't united before, we're united now.
Deb, I just want to thank you for all your work that you have done all these years. I've been following you, and you should take a lot of credit for just the how Windsor was created, but also the spirit of the town.
Oh,
and it's because, you know, when you create a community, this is how a community reacts with positive. You know, just they want to work together. And then it's only going to get better after something like this.
Right.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure where our spirit sat before the fire.
Right.
You know, you have people that complain about a lot of little things online, and I take that to heart.
Yeah.
And but when you have a fire like this and you see everybody come out the way they did, helping everybody else, yeah. thanking other people, still thanking people, still sending money yeah. to fire agencies and the scholarship fund, still trying to figure out what they can do, we've done our job. Now, there was a, I have to say to the old timers listening, there was a Windsor before some of us came to town in 1990.
Sure.
And we call them the old timers. They still, I say to them, am I an old timer yet? They said, oh no.
I'm still a newcomer.
I'm still a newcomer. Same problem. 29 years and I'm a newcomer, but I'll
yeah.
take it. And so it was, it's just a different kind of community now with more people.
So we have the issues of climate change that are exacerbating the problem. We have people moving or living in areas where there weren't houses previously that tend to be more rural and susceptible to that. We have the high winds. And then we have PG&E.
Which you work for.
And what my question to you on that is whether you as a city are looking at some sort of alternative to PG&E. I mean, people are talking about, you know, microgrids and doing more solar and or basically trying to minimize their dependency on power lines from PG&E because they started the fire.
Right.
Not on purpose, but through neglect and lack of ability to clear the brush around their poles or replace the poles or put the wires underground. So I just wonder if you have thoughts on that, if the city is looking at anything on that order.
The city isn't specifically, but we're carefully watching Sonoma Clean Power,
yeah.
right, who would probably take the lead for us in
yeah.
this area, and I'm very interested in that,
yeah.
and I would love to see something like that happen. In terms of microgrids, a few of us, and I'm one of the handful of people that were in meetings 15 years ago, 12
mm-hmm.
years ago, to talk about forming Sonoma Clean Power.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about microgrids then.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Strawn was a key proponent
right.
of that. And we knew years ago there should be microgrids, that we wanted to be independent from the grid. We wanted to be able to sell power back. You know, we wanted to put in solar in neighborhoods and have it be shared among other people's homes if
yeah.
they didn't have the right southern exposure.
Yeah.
So you need a microgrid to do that. And we were, you know, really trying to get to that point.
Yeah.
So the time is past due for...
Well, you know, and that really goes back to, I mean, you know, the city of Petaluma did the same thing.
Yeah,
when I was on the city council, we were talking about making sure that homes were set up for solar,
mm-hmm.
and we could just not get past the grid on the council.
Right.
You're a minority.
Yeah.
And today, all of a sudden, they want to move forward on this.
Right.
But it, you know, it's taken a long time, and I like to look 20, 30 years out. And it seems as though we are stuck in looking at today.
You're talking about the recent news that the city is looking at solar power for the city.
I'm looking at that also, yeah. but I'm also looking at making sure that homes
yeah.
have solar.
Yeah.
And really, what you need to do is you need to have a grid within a community
yeah.
instead of just having, you know, so each home is sharing.
Right.
And here we are almost 2020, and we're finally realizing that that's important, but we knew it was important 20 years ago.
We did know
or
that.
Or 10 years ago.
Many of us knew that then, yeah.
Well,
exactly.
And of course, you know,
yeah.
the fossil fuel industry knew for a long time that their product was dangerous. Similarly, like the tobacco industry, they tried to suppress information on that.
Yeah.
And of course, unfortunately, one of the major parties has sort of been helping push that line.
Well, I kind of like to shift gears a little bit here
because
since we're talking about climate change
yeah.
and, you know, we can talk about traffic, but I was decided to go to the SMART meeting this
yeah.
last week. And Deb Budge is on the SMART.
Yeah.
It's part of SMART. And there's a lot of exciting things that I learned. And I just felt so grateful that I happened to go to this particular meeting
yeah.
because we learned a lot, and I want Deb to let us know
yes.
what's going on, because to me, 101 cannot be widened past three lanes. We know that our community is going to be growing, the county,
mm-hmm.
and we need to really prepare for the future.
Yeah.
And the SMART train is really the future, and you have to educate people that oppose that to understand, if you look 20 years back to today and then 20 years in the future, where do we really want to be?
Yeah.
And why the SMART train to me is so important, because I go back to, you know, 1972 when BART could have come up in
right.
this area, and then that was kind of tossed away. And this is a really important opportunity in how we really connect the North Bay with San Francisco, and I think it's really exciting, and I'm just happy that I was at that meeting. So go ahead and let us know all the great things that are happening.
Well, that was a great meeting for you to be at. And I'll just add, not only are we connecting SMART to San Francisco now, but we have a lot of commuters coming from the East Bay, mm-hmm. which I'll talk about. And also the state wants us to expand eastward along
37.
Yeah, along 37, but it actually goes north of that. But it would connect to Southern Sonoma, Southern Napa,
yeah.
and connect with the Capital Corridor and the Amtrak train.
Yeah.
So SMART could really have, how many are those? 1, 2, 3 different connections to other regional areas.
It is exciting.
Would there be any way for it to link up with BART in the East Bay so you could go?
It does.
Oh, okay.
And this is I didn't realize this, but I'll start by saying that we unveiled on Wednesday a new schedule for SMART,
mm-hmm.
and it will start on January 1st, and it adds many more trains per day, and it connects with ferries, you know, so there's a lot more ferries. The ferry schedule is going to change to meet at Larkspur. We're also opening up the Larkspur Ferry Station in the second or third week of December,
mm-hmm.
and a new downtown Novato station the second or third week of December. But what I learned, just to go back to the East Bay, is that we also worked with seven transit agencies to work with the schedule so that the connections are really a lot better. So people can take buses and other forms of transportation to get to the train. So there's a bus 40 that leaves the San Rafael Transit Center and goes to East Bay. It goes to Richmond BART station. And we're seeing more and more people do that, which I wasn't aware of until Wednesday, that there's a bus 40. And so we've got routes where it will connect really well with bus 40 and take people to Richmond BART.
So it's a bus.
It's a bus.
Which is great.
But it connects. It's a commuter bus, so it's a straight line to the station. It doesn't stop along the way. So.
Well, you know, I don't think people realize, I mean, how important these connections are.
They are.
And, we can't have BART, so let's go ahead and figure other ways. And the bus connections are just integral in getting people out of their cars and more people using SMART.
That said, anytime there's a little bit of complexity with having to switch from a train to a bus to another train, for some people, that even if it's the reality is it's not that big a deal, it's a mental thing where people, and what's really interesting though is they don't think about, yeah, but you're not sitting in traffic.
You know, I will say something about that. Young people know this.
Yes.
They know that this is how I'm going to get on the train.
Yep.
I know I get on bus 40 and then I go into Richmond and I get at that BART station and I get to where I want to be. In our age group, sometimes we don't really think. We're looking at the complexity of it. Younger people are not as complex as we are.
And I think that's a fair point. I think the other thing is just habit. We
exactly.
are from a generation that was used to having my automobile,
right.
my car, I can go wherever I want, anytime. It's a freedom that's been so ingrained in many of us, and it's hard to break that pattern. Whereas, for example, if you live in Europe, you're very used to using public transit, or even New York. I mean, who owns cars in New York? Part of it is just a learning thing.
Right.
But that's kind of what I was like when I winced a little bit when you said it's by bus, simply because I do know that. And I mean, ideally it would be a direct train linkage somehow, but I guess we're just not going to.
Well, let's focus on what we have there.
Exactly.
I'm going to change the thing. I'm talking to Richmond. So there are thousands of people going to Richmond every day. So let's talk about, I want to talk about the good stuff that we've just
announced.
Yeah, this is all good stuff.
Yeah,
I mean,
Richmond is
all good.
Not our main destination right now.
Yeah. But I mean, I think it's important to understand that, because a lot of times, even people want to get to a certain area, they have park and rides that a car will come and they'll take 4 people to a certain destination.
Right.
I mean, so there's all kinds of other opportunities, But SMART
is,
I want to hear more about SMART and more about the Larkspur connection.
Yeah.
And so when that's going to be dedicated. Yeah. And then talk about the Novato and the Windsor. And let's talk about what we're going to do as far as how we're going to get to Healdsburg and to Cloverdale and hopefully get the Petaluma Station, Eastside Station, open.
Okay. So the new schedule that's being unveiled, we've increased the number of train trips. We have 34 trips per day right now. It will be 38.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did with those extra trains, and we're going to use six two-car train sets instead of the current four because we had bought some new rail cars, so we have those. But the best thing that we did was we closed those morning and afternoon commute gaps that people did not like. The 90-minute gaps are closed.
Okay.
And we're going to be running trains every 32 minutes, southbound and northbound, during commute hours. And so commute hours are, you know, we pulled people, when are you commuting? You know, so the peak commute hours, we're running trains every 32 minutes, which is exactly what people wanted.
So my sister actually commutes to San Francisco, and sometimes she goes by bus, sometimes she drives. She's done the SMART connection before, and it just took a bit for her, but I think this would be great if there's a direct, I mean, that makes it, I imagine, a much more smoother ride for someone. They just get on SMART, and then it's going to go direct to Larkspur, and then they go from there. They don't have to wait for a bus. And
right. So the Larkspur station, we're in the final stages now where we're testing the schedule, but all of the physical testing is done. We've got our permits to start operating soon.
It's supposed to be before the end of the year.
It
right?
will be. And okay. so it's either... It's
no, 2019.
20. Yeah, it's either the second Friday in December or the third Friday. And we can't... We're waiting for the people from the federal government, like the head of the Federal Rail Transportation Agency. We're looking for their schedules. Like,
right.
And is Governor Newsom coming, and what's his schedule? So that's it's either one of those two Fridays is my best guess.
So you're optimistic it'll actually start before the end of the year.
I know it will.
Okay.
We're just trying to pick schedules and you know, look at people's schedules so we can, you know, nail down the date. What the Larkspur Landing Shopping Center people are doing is they're going to host our party. So whatever Friday that is, it's a big, giant ribbon cutting. It's a party.
Wow.
You know.
And that'll be in Larkspur.
In Larkspur.
We should do Petaluma Community Access on the road that day.
That's a good idea.
And make sure we're down there for that dedication. And get a videoing of that.
So the train will be running that day, right? So we could technically run to the...
I think so. I know it's running. It would run the following day. I assume it would run.
That would be magic.
That would be fun.
I mean,
can I clarify something? But in 2020, I thought in January was the ribbon cutting.
No, that's the new schedule.
Oh, that's the new
schedule.
So this
is what
I
need to explain.
I'm confused. Thank you.
And you were at the meeting.
And I was at the meeting. I'm confused.
A lot of information.
we were given a lot of information. And so the new schedule starts January 2nd. It's online. People can look at it and start planning your new trips. But what we're going to do in, say, December 13th or 20th is we're just going to add Larkspur on to the end of the current schedule. So we will be running Larkspur in December, but we won't have this enhanced schedule with more trains until January 2nd.
Okay.
And so so at the very end, we'll have a new schedule when we announce the Larkspur opening that will say, and the train will continue from Summerfield to Larkspur on that schedule. And then the new one will be unveiled, and people, the trains will be running on January 2nd.
I kind of missed that gap.
You missed that little bit of information. And then Novato. So Novato wanted a third station, and we said, well, we're not paying for it because we offered you two stations and two locations, and Novato went back and forth with the SMART board multiple times. They couldn't decide where they should put their two stations.
Hmm.
Well, they put one of them near where Fireman's Fund was
right.
because there were a lot of employees there then. Well, then Fireman's Fund went away.
Mm.
There were people in Novato that didn't want a downtown station because they didn't want high-density development, you know, downtown Novato, which is exactly what you think you would want in a downtown. Not everybody. But there were some people who would come up to Windsor and say, show us around downtown Windsor. Show us what you've done with condos and mixed use. And there were, you know, half the people wanted it, half didn't. Anyway, so Novato said, after we'd started the train, we want a downtown station. And we said, okay, but you're going to pay for it. It's a lot more money to add a station in the middle of the line than it is to add one at the end, especially when the trains are operating. So Novato paid almost $8 million for that station out of their own general fund.
Wow.
So that's why if anybody says, well, how come they got three? Well, they paid for it, and it was difficult.
Right.
You know, I will tell you, I have a doctor down in Novato, and I really wanted to take the train, and then I would just walk to the, you know, it's maybe a quarter of a mile away, whatever.
Sure.
But I didn't have a station that was close enough to do this.
Mm.
And so I'm actually glad to hear this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just so important that people realize that, I mean, if I'm thinking about getting on the train instead of getting on the car, that's really big because, you know, I like my freedom. But I also like the idea of getting on the train and then being able to walk a quarter of a mile because then it's a quarter of a mile back. You have the downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually been looking at the downtown in Novato, and it's lovely.
It's got a lot of potential.
A lot of potential and a lot of great development for housing down there. And people just need to understand that to make a train successful, you have to have high-density housing. And people are having a hard time getting to that point, but I think we're getting closer and closer.
Yeah, we're getting closer to that.
Yeah, and so, this is,
In terms of running Novato before the end of the year, we're going to run trains on the weekends to the Novato downtown station so that anybody that wants to do any holiday shopping down there can do that. And it will sort of, you know, boost the downtown what's there in Novato right now.
Of course, we would encourage everyone to shop in Petaluma.
Oh, well, you know, winter. But, you know, the other thing is that I'm thinking Petaluma, people always say, oh, Petaluma has the great restaurants. Well, I would love to take a train to any city, go to great restaurants, and I can have a cocktail.
But you don't have to. You're already in Petaluma.
Well, a lot of people do come here. I can't tell you how many people I've talked to that take the train to Petaluma.
Yes.
And I tell them the shortcut. You know, you get off at the station, you kind of go in between the, you know, walk along the river, turn left. There's the Mexican restaurant, have some margaritas. I tell them how to do it.
That's got to be improved. that little area there needs
to be. Well, you know, that we can talk about it. I have this pet peeve between the D Street Bridge and the rail crossing on Lakeville. The city council years ago should have taken those telephone poles, buried them underground, and we could have actually widened that and made it a more efficient way of moving in this very important area because D Street is not, traffic's not going to get less.
Right.
And Lakeville is an important roadway. And this goes back to we need to look 20 years out instead of just seeing what's in front of us.
I just want to remind the listeners that you're listening to KPCA LP in Petaluma, California. It's 103.3 FM. It's also online at kpca.fm. And we are with Deborah Fudge today. This is Inside Petaluma, and we're talking about Smart Rail. Now, since you're on the board, you're probably familiar with what's happening with our potential station on the east side of town, and I know Janice is very familiar with that process. I think maybe our listeners would be curious to know where that's going, especially in light of some of the recent news.
Just to be fair, I'm sure there's things that Deb can't actually talk about because of closed sessions, and so I want to be respectful of that, but I'd like to hear a little bit about that, but I'd also really want to get into the sales tax and why it's what SMART is doing as far as promoting and extending that, because we want to look 20, 30 years out, and that is really key to making that happen. And so we can maybe talk about Corona briefly and then go into the sales tax.
So SMART is anxious for a second station in Petaluma. That was a promise we actually did make, and it is something that we will fulfill. We need the money and the location to be able to build that station. And so the deal that's been floating around for a while, it's changed multiple times.
Yeah, it's confusing.
Well, that's where I can't talk about that. I would just say look to others, not SMART.
Sure.
But SMART owns 5 acres downtown next to the train station. We're near where the gravel parking lot is now, sort of. I guess that's east of the museum. And we would love for that to be, we would love to sell that, have that be high-density housing that and a cute mixed-use village that would actually serve the SMART station and have all those riders be able to walk out their front doors and get on the train. And we're willing to take the money from the sale of that property to build the Corona station. So then you get into the Corona details with the person who owns that property, because we don't, and that's those are the things I can't talk
right.
about. But Smart is anxious to make a deal that suits Smart, but also the city of Petaluma.
Well, and my concern is that, you know, what I hear is downtown is important. Downtown is important. Downtown Petaluma is important. Well, so is this Eastside Station.
Yeah.
And I don't want a council member just to go ahead and sell Eastside short for the downtown station, because we really need to have, you need high density around a rail station. And this developer keeps coming back with single family.
Yeah,
and
that's
now
the problem.
And now they've kind of adjusted that. Right. And they just, and then there was a threat that, well, we'll just do appeal to the city council.
Right. So that is, I think, and it has nothing to do with Smart, I don't think. It's
no,
just
that's
that,
a Petaluma City issue.
But, no, exactly.
But the challenge is the developer doesn't seem to be as interested in transit-oriented development, the kind of mixed-use sort of development that we'd like to see near a station.
Well, but I think, you know, I mean, I'm going to go back to Warmington just really quick. It's amazing how a council member can bring that forward, bypass the whole process, bring it to the city council for a kind of a bogus vote, and yet they can't do this for the east side of Petaluma. And this is why sometimes I want district elections, and I realize that's a negative thing, but we don't have a lot of representation, even though we have two Eastsiders on the city council, but they are not representing the north quadrant.
In terms of district elections, I would say you've got to be on the radar for that, because Windsor just went to district elections.
Yeah.
We wondered why we were forced to do that ahead of Petaluma and Rona Park. Rona Park is working on that. So
we're a charter city is part of
the reason. Oh, is that why?
Because of a charter city, the process is a little bit different. But tell us quickly about the district elections, just maybe a minute, about positive, negative, and now since it has to be, what's your thought on that? Because I really want to get into the smart tax.
Yeah, and then I want to talk about the smart weekend schedule, too, because there's exciting
perfect.
News on that. I'm not sure what Windsor has entered into district elections. Our elections will be a year from now. So we divided Windsor into four districts with a mayor that would be elected every 2 years. The reason we did that was not because we're such a big city that we need
every 2 years.
Every 2 years. We did that because it was really hard to divide Windsor into five districts. We had the freeway separating us. You have census tracts. It was just every configuration we came up with was awkward.
I actually like a mayor at large, and I would have preferred 4 years mayor at large.
Yeah, we did 2 years because people in Windsor wanted to vote. They're sad when it's a district. They only get to vote for somebody, one person, every 4 years. And before, they were voting for two people, and then 2 years later, they vote for three people. Mm-hmm. And now they get one every 4 years. So when that's why we did the mayor every 2 years. So they get the mayor every 2 years and their representative every 4 years. So they get more bites at the apple as to who represents them. That's why we did it.
Wait a minute. To clarify, so you're a five-member board. The mayor is every 2 years, but the four districts are every four years. So they're on the same cycle.
No, we had to split them
up. Well, no, except for the mayor.
No, they're still split up. 2 years, 1 year, 2 years.
Okay.
You know, we split them up they're staggered terms.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
let's talk about some successes with SMART. We had a representative here a while back, and I think they said something like 500,000 cars off the road in terms of trips.
We've had 560,000 riders that was announced at last week's meeting.
Okay.
We've had almost 6,000 people in wheelchairs and 160,000 bicycles.
Wow.
And so those are people riding first mile, last mile on their bikes to and from the train station.
How many disabled people?
6,000.
Wow.
It's the weirdest thing, because I'll run into these people that opposed SMART from the beginning and are convinced it's not the best use of our tax dollars and all this stuff, and I always hear from them, yeah, and no one's even riding it. Now, every time I see the train, it's full of people. I will confess, I haven't ridden it yet. I'm a little embarrassed.
Oh, my God.
I still haven't ridden it.
I went down to I have an announcement. I have forgotten it. This wasn't on my list of things to say today, but SMART is running free Thanksgiving Day and Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Okay.
Thanksgiving weekend, and I want to see you on that train, Jason.
I will probably.
It's free.
I know.
Come on, Tipo.
You know, it's not a money thing. It's simply, for one, I don't commute.
Well, Matt, you know what
I work
else?
In town.
What people are doing is they're not, it's not just commuters. There's a lot of people having fun. Like I said, a lot of people are coming for dinner in Petaluma.
Yep.
They're going to restaurants in San Rafael.
Yes.
So there's a restaurant there called Soul Food, S-O-L.
My daughter loves that
people
place.
People love
and
that.
And she's done exactly that. She and her friends get on the train and they
go down and visit downtown San Rafael. Yeah. Downtown San Rafael is actually our number one stop right now, which surprised us. We thought it'd be Santa Rosa. It's San Rafael.
No, I'm not surprised.
So
it's
just
Santa
take a little trip and have some fun.
Yeah, maybe over the break. That's a good idea.
Excellent. Okay, let's go to the tax or the sales.
Well, I was just wanting to. I was going to get to the tax. I wanted to preface it by saying how awesome SMART has been.
Now, and I already know that.
And,
you're right.
And but the listeners need to know. But in order to keep it going and keep the promise and make it even better, we do need to keep the funding. So maybe now we can get into the how we do that, how we pay
right.
for it.
So SMART is putting a sales tax renewal, no new taxes, read my lips, right, on the March ballot. And the reason we're doing that 9 years early. And so it's an extension of the existing tax. Whether people vote yes or no on this tax, they're still paying the tax for 9 more years no matter what. This is just an extension 30 years out into the future. So it's the tax doesn't end if people vote no, and that's what people really need to understand. It's set until 2029.
So
it's just an extension into, like, 2050.
Well, this is good to know because that means if I'm assuming it will pass. I think it will pass. If it doesn't pass, then we'll have an opportunity to renew it.
No.
No?
Well, yes and no. So that's what I want the other thing I want to make clear. SMART lost, if you look at our 20-year tax measure, if you look from 2008 to 2028, and then you consider the money that we did not get during the Great Recession,
right.
We never made that money up.
Right.
So people started buying things, you know, 4 years after the recession ended, but we never made up those millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. So we would be short about $300 million in that 20-year time frame that we need for operations if everything stays the same as it is now and we don't have another recession. So we're already running, you know, short on operational money that we thought we'd get and that we thought we'd already have in the bank. And so we have an opportunity, if this measure passes, to refinance our debt, which will save us $12 million a year.
Right. Because you can go and say, look, we have this revenue guaranteed for, okay.
If the revenue's guaranteed out, you know, 30 more years, so 10 plus 20, then the bond agencies will let us refinance the bonds. We can save $12 million. There's a dog under our table.
That totally freaks me out.
So people know what that is. There's a dog under the table.
I put my hand under my seat for a minute, and then it was, like, wet, and it was a
It's
tongue.
Janice's dog.
But I didn't expect that, and it was, like, really weird.
You guys are fun. But I'm going to get back to the money part, because this is really passionate. So people, if we all vote yes for the tax extension, you're still paying the quarter cent sales tax, it's no new taxes, it will enable SMART to save $12 million a year, which we need for operations to make up for the money that we didn't get.
That sounds fiscally responsible.
It's very fiscally responsible.
It absolutely
we
is.
Get more bang for our buck.
And so when you said, oh, we might get another bite at the apple, if it fails now, we'll try again later.
Yeah, that's wrong.
That's wrong because the reason that's wrong is in 2 years, in 2023, 2024, let's say it didn't pass in 2020.
And the debt costs are going to get higher.
The debt costs will go up, and we would be eating into our reserves.
Right.
We don't want to eat into our reserves.
And then you have to cut service.
Then we have to cut service. So this measure needs to pass in March so that we don't cut service.
Thank you for clarifying.
Well, I think it's important for our listeners. I mean, if you're listening to this and you support this, please, you know, sign up to support this and get engaged of how we can actually make it happen. Because this is, if we really care about our children and our grandchildren's future, this is the future.
Right.
And it's not car oriented. It needs to be done. We're talking about climate change.
Yep.
And you have really, thank you for explaining it.
Well. And there's enough money, I should explain, it's not just for current service. There's enough money in that we can determine in this ballot initiative to get to Windsor operationally wise. And there's also enough operations money to get to Healdsburg and Cloverdale. So we don't need, once this passes, we're set with operations and increasing the number of trains and adding the Corona station. There's enough money to operate that Corona station and all the maintenance that goes along with that well into the future. And, you know, for another 30 years, if people vote in March, that'll be it. we're set, we can continue to expand.
So is this a two-thirds?
It's a two-thirds vote. So
it's only Sonoma County. It's not Marin County.
Sonoma and Marin both have to vote.
So it is Sonoma and Marin.
Right.
That's where I was.
Both
that's
counties
what
vote.
I needed to understand.
So back to sustainability and climate change and all that good stuff. This is a great step towards giving people an alternative to getting behind the wheel of their automobile. It does run on fossil fuels, and I know it's clean, relatively speaking, and I know, obviously, the impacts of reducing car traffic is a good thing. Having said that, if you're thinking 30 years down the line, is there someone in the smart board that's thinking maybe we could transition to electric at some point?
It's possible for us to do that. And when we bought these rail cars, we looked into that. Could they be converted? And they can be. Oh. The reason we didn't do it up front was electrification was, you know, new at that time,
sure.
But it would have severely raised the cost. And
yeah.
We couldn't have gotten as many stations as we have
right.
now. So we had to make a call. Do we electrify now? You know, what kind of rail cars do we buy? And the whole point was we knew we needed to get as far as we could.
So, like every show, we end up talking about a lot more stuff than we anticipate, and then we start running out of time, and that's where we're at. So if there's anything you wanted to add before we sign off?
I have a last thought, and that's our weekend schedule. So I was talking about weekday.
Uh-huh.
Weekends. We're going to start trains at 7:30 in the morning on weekends, which will get you to the Larkspur Ferry by 9, and you'll be able to catch a new northbound ferry, a new ferry, at 9 a.m. and get to San Francisco earlier on the weekends. So it's a new schedule. We want everybody to try out the new schedule starting January 2nd. You're going
to
love it.
And I am looking forward to having you back. To talk more about SMART.
Right,
I would love to come back. This was fun.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you so much,
you.
Deborah Fudge, for joining us. I've been here hosting on behalf of Cindy Thomas, who couldn't make it, with Janice Carter Thompson. This has been Inside Petaluma. You can listen to this show and our other previously broadcast shows on InsidePetaluma.com or KPCALP-FM 103.3. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Hello, hello, hello. You are tuned in to KPCA 103.3 FM. Brown Boy Talking will be with you here in just a few moments while I figure out